Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Nothing Is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin. For season two, we are bringing some more guests into our Beatles pod here in Dublin. And we're delighted this week that we have with us Mr. Robin Hitchcock. Hello, Robin.
Hi there, Jason.
It's great to have you here. I'm assuming anybody listening to the podcast does know who Robin Hitchcock is. He's one of Britain's preeminent singer-songwriters, performers. He's got a recording catalogue that goes back over 40 years and is... just one of the great treasures of British music. But we are here to talk about the Beatles because they loom large in everybody's legend, but they're a term we've heard you talk about, a theme we've heard you talk about many times in the past. And one of our opening gambits whenever we talk to people about the Beatles is your first exposure, because you're the right age to have to have them hit you as a kid, really.
I was 10, yeah. Thinking about it. And like a lot of things, they sort of came out of the corner of the eye, you know. So I think I actually heard Love Me Do a couple of times, but I don't quite know how, because there was hardly any pop radio in those days. There was the Top 20 on Sunday afternoons. There was Radio Luxembourg, but I don't think I was even listening to that. And There was maybe something else on. It was the Light Programme. I may have backdated it into my memory, but there was a very cold winter, 62 into 63. And I just remember as it was beginning to thaw out, the word The Beatles was appearing a lot. Other kids at school, I mean, that's when I turned 10, you know, were coming in with the New Musical Express or disc and talking about The Beatles. And in my sort of timid, snobbish way, I thought, The Beatles, that's a silly name. And then, funnily enough, my dad came into the room where my sister and I were watching Fireball XL5 on black and white television. That was the sort of precursor to Thunderbirds, if you remember that back. These puppets, space puppets. And he just bought a transistor radio, and he said, "Oh, you might like to listen to this." And he brought in, it was Alan Freeman on Pick of the Pops, you know, the top 20 program. And we thought, "Oh, Dad, we're watching Fireball XL5. but he brought it in, and it was the Beatles were playing. I think they had, I guess, From Me to You had come out. And we were hooked. The next week, we watched it with the sound down. And the next week, we didn't bother to watch Fireball XL5. We put the transistor radio in a pram and we pushed it around outside like it was a baby. And and then that was it. It was really quick. But I think we were on the cusp of Please, Please Me and From Me to You.
Yeah.
So that's where I came in. And by the time She Loved You was out, I was a fully paid up Beatlemaniac.
Yeah. So your father was encouraging you to listen to pop music. That must have been quite...
He had an eye or an ear or a nose, various parts of the body for developments, for innovations. And I think he thought, this is something that the kids might like. It wasn't necessarily his jam, but he thought it might be ours. And
quite progressive.
Fair play to him. Yeah. He was very good with that sort of thing. I remember him taking me down to, he said, you're going to want to go down to Portsmouth tomorrow morning. We were living in Hampshire at that point. At 8, I said, I'll take you down to Southampton tomorrow. And I said, why, what's that? And he said, the Bob Dylan tickets are going on sale. He didn't care for Dylan himself, but he knew I'd like that, you know.
Yeah.
He was an interesting fella.
Was he musical or?
Not at all, but he liked a nice tune. And it was interesting. I remember watching, there was a TV program with them doing... in my life, 2 years later, this is 65, 2 years after he'd appeared, the epiphany had come on the transistor radio. You know,
yes.
My sister and I were a bit bigger then, and we probably got a new pram or something. And he, I remember sitting there watching it with him, and he was going, oh, they're really good, aren't they, the Beatles? Oh, they're really good, aren't they, Joycey Love? He'd say to my mum, and my mum was called Joyce. She'd just go, like that, like a rodent that was quite hard to impress. She didn't like to commit herself. She was not an enthusiast, but my dad was an enthusiast. And he, even if he, I don't know, he got it. It was very, very interesting what he would get, you know.
But that's an interesting microcosm of 1963 because there's the youth who are finding the music and these four guys irresistible. But there's also this kind of parallel, you know, particularly, you know, the Sunday Times article and all this parallel thing of people giving the Beatles kind of a stamp of authority saying, no, this is a different thing and these are special. This is a special kind of artistic change here in pop music.
Ah, you mean, was it William Mann? The article with the
Aeolian
cadences and the stuff that John Lennon was very sniffy about. Yeah, well, they were right.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing is, the Beatles came in at so many... They got through on so many different levels.
Yes.
I mean, watching Hard Day's Night, the other thing that struck me about them was that they were basically a comedy act. They were like the Marx Brothers. They worked as a team, and I'm sure the parallel was drawn at the time, but I hadn't seen the Marxes yet. But you know, these four guys who moved around in just, they set themselves up. The only other band I can think of like that was Madness, who just knew where to put themselves. Mm. And that's quite an art. You know? I don't know if the Rolling Stones could do that or you know, the Monkees could do it, but they were actors.
Yeah.
So that they came in as, you know, supposedly didn't George Martin think of the Beatles? He wasn't sure about the songs and he wasn't sure who the lead singer should be, but he thought they were a great comedy team.
Yeah.
Yes, he said it was the humor. It was that's the sort of the struck in their personality.
Yeah.
The charm, I suppose.
Yes.
They had a charm that comes across in interviews or on TV appearances.
Well, they were charming, but they were also cheeky.
Mm.
But somehow, you know, Lennon was the edgiest of them, but they were all a bit, it was all slightly risky, you know, but it wasn't full-on offensive.
No.
Left to his own devices, he probably would have been, but he had the others to be good cops.
Yeah.
And he could also be terribly funny. So you didn't quite know what you were going to get with him. He was probably a pretty disturbed individual and probably not great to run across. But you know... but then at times, apparently he was, you know, so you don't know, but it was just this thing of the four of them, you know, you wonder what, if they hadn't kicked out Pete Best, would Pete Best have fitted in the same? Would he have been the same as, you know, Ringo's a masterstroke.
Yes.
Yes.
But my own theory is that any band is only as good as its drummer, you know, and I think Ringo was the final bit that turned them into them. You know, and I was watching Hard Day's Night. It was on over Christmas.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wasn't intending to watch it because I hadn't seen it in about 10 years. But it is a striking piece of, I find sometimes the early Beatles gets overlooked. Everyone gets excited about the later stuff because, you know, there's maybe more of a narrative to it or, you know, something like Abbey Road fits in more with modern music. But early Beatles, they just, it's amazing how they stick out from what's going on around them and all the time. There's one tiny flash spit in Hard Day's Night where they run past some World War II bombed out remains, you know, and you would, and you think that's still in the air, that is what they are coming out of and what they're trying to represent a change from, you know, it's really incredible, you know.
Well, I suppose it took a long time to recover from World War II,
mm.
But it was, I mean, I was, funny, I was looking at the movie and I thought, yeah, gosh, this is where World War II really ends.
Yeah.
But except it was in my lifetime, I was right there and I was brought up with, you know, all the war comics, all the Germans, you know, Mein Gott, Himmel, Teufel, yeah. explosions everywhere. You know, there's that bit where Lennon's in the bath doing German explosion noises, and everybody, all the British kids were brought up to, British boys were brought up to do German explosion noises and have a sort of morbid fascination with the Luftwaffe and all that stuff. And, you know, Airfix kits, being Jewish, wouldn't do a swastika decal on the tail of their planes, whereas the Ravel people would. And I was fascinated by swastikas, you know, all that Nazi apparatus. And but I also knew very early on what it was, you know, we knew about the camps and everything. And, but I mean, this is slight bit of a diversion, but yeah, it was. It was, you know, the timing was fantastic. Mm. That it all seems like, it seems like it's a higher power engineering the whole thing. How come you got three incredibly talented songwriters with straight brown hair, 5'11", growing up in the same city, any one of whom could have fronted a band or been a solo act, if you like, certainly John and Paul, but George also wrote good enough songs. And then they hook up with another straight head, half inch shorter bloke, Ringo. But Ringo is the, like you said, you know, that's when it fits into place completely. And, you know, but they're all in one city.
That's I have a friend that cites that as proof of a divine intervention, you know.
Well,
that can't be a
point.
That can't be just or aliens, you know.
Something out there, you know. And I mean, also doing it in Liverpool, because the other big thing was the class system, certainly in Britain, in England, you know. There was the BBC, Oxford, Cambridge, the central core, the sort of establishment, if you like. And then you had the lower orders, and then you had regionals. And the purpose of, you know, the BBC and the Oxbridge, would you just get a laugh out of making everybody else out to be a yokel or an oaf, you know?
Mm. Or talk like that, don't I, mate? Or, all right, come in front, come from West Country, don't I, like that? Mm.
If the Beatles had come from London, they would have had to have fitted into a class. Would they have been laundered? I mean, you know, Cliff Richard was sounding posh by the time he did Espresso Bongo. Mm. There wasn't even an estuary accent in those days.
Yeah.
But you know, if they'd been too posh, or if they'd been too down market, it wouldn't have captured everybody. But being Liverpool was regional, so it was. It was slightly outside of the class system already, you know. And then Liverpool's also where kind of Lancashire meets Ireland. So you've got that, you know, the Manchester always strikes me as quite dour, whereas Liverpool's got that, it's an edgy place, but there's a lot of humour to it. Mm. And, you know, the voice goes up and down and that stuff, you know. And it's just the timing, the place, the perfect, the numbers, you know, it all just seems uncanny.
Yeah, if it was a fictional story, you almost wouldn't believe it. The amount of things that have to happen in a straight line for it to have delivered, you know, it is quite the thing.
Yes, that's. I think maybe, don't you think George ought to come from, you know, he should come from Salford, and I feel like maybe Paul, people moved over from Newcastle. If we're outside of London, I can accept, but, you know, let's just sort of move them, bring them in. Yeah, quite.
A little bit more acceptable.
Yeah, I think it's more likely, you know, but...
There was obviously a sense at that time that British society or English society was looking for something. The society was ready. You know, you had things like Profumo. You had the Beyond the Fringe, that there was that sort of breaking down.
You also had people like David Bailey and all those coming through as well, who had also would have maybe tried to break a class fame system as well.
You got all that, you know, and you got... That was the other great thing, was that, you know, that you had the upper classes starting to aspire downwards. So Peter Cook... you know, Peter Cook had his sort of two big personae was, you know, Strieb Griebling.
Yes.
Well, yes, that sort of voice, you know. And then there was E.L. Wasty, who was like this, you know. And he kind of basically aspired downwards, you hear him, I heard him recorded in 1960, 61 for an interview, and he sounds like this. He's basically got one of these the older voices. Mm. And then by 1974, he's got an estuary voice, you know. it's just the beat, you know. So some of them, the rock pop groups aspired upwards, and the Beyond the Fringes the aspired downwards, yeah. You know. Mm. And it was all suddenly it was just really, really meteorological.
See, what I think Lennon in particular was able to do was, as you say, they were cheeky. Mm. And it's that point where they seem to know on camera the line that they could
yes.
just push that line.
Yes.
Where people, they're laughing slightly because they're feeling guilty that they're laughing. You know, my well, mother, if I tell my mother a slightly risque yes. joke, she laugh because she feels slightly guilty that she's yes. doing something that's not quite permitted or not quite yes. allowed. And I think the Beatles, Lennon in particular, yeah. allowed people to do that. They're sort of laughing and they're going along and they're feeling slightly guilty and that sort of, you know, a little sort of yeah. thrill at doing it.
Yeah.
And the Beatles really just exploited that, I think.
Rattle Your Jewelry.
Well, Rattle Your Jewelry
exactly.
is the one.
Exactly.
But it wasn't, you know, like screw you up there, you know, yeah. you've got stuff that belongs to everybody else. Yeah. It was
there's
cheeky
a subtle
it was charming
yeah. to it.
But
and,
Lennon had yeah. sold it to Brian Epstein as being, I'm going to say, rattle your fucking jewellery. He was going to curse.
And then he
brings that back from the last
wife. He was going to say it.
Yeah. But I think
rattle your fucking jewellery.
Yeah. But I think he did it to because he was playing with Epstein.
Oh, yeah. So Epstein took the fucking out.
So Epstein, I think, was sort of
Epstein
sitting
was like,
there
don't
thinking,
say anything.
Is he going to do this? Is he going to do this? But I think it was the same way he was kind of playing with Epstein unnerving
so
him.
He probably, I didn't know, he thought it out in advance, but oh, okay, wow.
Yeah, so
because you can see him lean into when he's doing that, you can see Lennon leaning into the microphone and with a kind of grin on his face that he knows he's going to say
it.
Something cheeky. And yeah. I say cheeky I think that's exactly the right word.
But did you watch that going out at the time, the Royal Variety performance? When
no, I did I remember throwing a big fit because they wouldn't let me watch the Beatles because Grandma wanted to watch Black and White Minstrel Show or something that.
It's a sign of the times.
Mom, Dad, it's not fair. My cousin came up and sort of, you know, him showing me some Pinky and Perky slides in bed as a consolation because I don't know, but they obviously felt politically it was Grandma's turn, not mine. And, what a little brat.
and the movie Hard Day's Night, were you going to see that?
I saw that when it came out and I saw it about a week ago and I hadn't seen it since 1964. I saw it at Staines Odeon with my friend Gregory. And so I remembered very little except for Wilfred Bramble coming up through the trapdoor. What I didn't realise was that he actually came up twice through a trapdoor.
Yes.
But I was just amazed at how good they were.
It's still fresh.
As a team.
Yeah, it really is striking.
You know, because also, like you said, people tend to get drawn towards the later stuff because in a way, the songs are more developed, you know, and the differences are developing and all that lot. But they worked so well, and I thought, God, I can't believe, you know, John and Paul are that close, or, you know, Ringo is looking for tension between Paul and George, you know, who you feel were really kind of, that was another big fault line. Mm. Everyone got along with Ringo because he wasn't a threat, you know, and he made a quarter of the money that the rest of them did. But, you know, it was just... the early Beatles as an entity was miraculous.
And the songs from that era, I think, they're full of joy. There's something just very naive and very engaging and joyful.
Well, there is, because they hadn't been given dope yet by Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan was, to me, was the serpent, you know, in the Garden of Eden. He brought knowledge. He brought the apple.
But it had to happen, though, didn't it?
I suppose so. But, you know, that was, I mean, whether he'd given them marijuana or not, they were being corrupted by his music. They were losing their innocence. But Dylan gave the whole thing a brain, which made it more potent. Otherwise, it would just have basically been like four Elvises. You know, it was sort of, there wasn't anything, there was no danger in the the lyrics and the intent of the, you know.
It was entertainment.
It was entertainment. Yeah. It was fine. It didn't, it was like a 15-word vocabulary.
But it's interesting, you know. Yes, you know,
my friend Diamond Ring, yeah, you know. I mean, they put Britain on the map with the word yeah, you know. It was just like, that's what, that's their big contribution, you know, one of many.
And Dylan, at what point then, Dylan's obviously a huge influence as well on the Beatles, but also on you. But were you aware at the time of Dylan's influence on the band, or you,
No, I wasn't aware of that. I didn't get into Dylan until 1966 when Revolver came out. I mean, at the same time, you know, I remember hearing like a Rolling Stone and Rubber Soul kind of almost daily basis at school, but I didn't really associate them, you know, and I didn't notice them changing because I was changing, you know.
Yeah.
I was 10. That's the thing for me personally. I was 10 when From Me to You came out, and I was 16 when Abbey Road came out.
Yeah.
I was 17 when Let It Be came out. I left school and the Beatles broke up, you know. So without... You know, Bob Dylan didn't hand me personally a marijuana cigarette, but I suppose I was going through a lot of the same stages that they were going through, apart from not being a million seller or being able to play the guitar yet. But, you know, but just the evolution was so extreme.
Yes.
The evolution in society.
One of the things that we're always very interested in, or I'm always interested in, I'm much older than than Jason, but I sort of, it was this, I was experiencing the Beatles from sort of 74, 75, 76 was when I started picking up on them. And I'm so with hindsight, it's an easy thing to say, well, you can see Dylan influencing Lennon, Lennon influencing Dylan, Pink Floyd, Sid Barrett, whatever. You can see that all with hindsight. But at the time, it's always fascinating to me how that seemed to be unfolding, if it did seem to be unfolding, to the sort of contemporary observer. And you know, you're saying you weren't really conscious at the time.
No, because it was a very different me by the end.
Yeah. But people weren't thinking about these things at the time. There weren't big think pieces in magazines, or there wasn't a lot of access to the peripheral journalism or media about pop culture, was there?
That's
really
where that developed. That's where those 5-page articles on the Grateful Dead started appearing in Rolling Stone, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And in Britain, you know, the pop press, a serious pop press was looking to evolve, because it had all it had been like sort of, you know, 3 paragraphs about what their favorite clothes were and, you know, where they might play in a pub and what kind of girls they like to date. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
The journalism, in-depth journalism, had to evolve to keep up with music that took itself seriously, because by 1969, 1970, you could go into pop music, or was it, because it became rock, didn't it?
Yeah.
Another one of the great changes. You could go into rock taking yourself as seriously as, you know, you might be the new Benjamin Britten or something, you know, and Pete Townsend did.
Yeah.
You know, yes. He was, as far as he was concerned, he was a modern composer.
I read that, you know, you had a band in art school called The Beatles, spelled correctly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, I always think that people had this notion of, well, we're just going to look at our watch and wait for the next Beatles to come along. But there was never going to be another Beatles. And, you know, was it...
No.
In terms of being a Beatles fan in that kind of post-Beatles wasteland, was that... It's sort of a... In retrospect, it seems a bit like a no man's land. We don't have the big Beatles industry that we have now.
No.
And people thought, well, pop music was seemed to be a thing that, well, that's something that happens.
Yes.
It didn't have a long tail. So as you kind of evolved into somebody who wrote your own music and performed your own music, you know, what did it mean to reference the Beatles at that time, or to feel them at that time?
Well, I think I was aware of being a throwback even as I started. You know, I started my art school band, the Beatles, was in 72, 73. And I remember somebody, we played a couple of art school dances, and somebody said, oh, yeah, your band's fun, but, you know, do you play any bump and grind? You know, anything funky? You know, and I was very aware of sinking into a... Once I'd gone past the portals of 1970, that basically it was a kind of no man's land. It was an abyss. It was a scary place full of burning oil drums and, you know, villains swooping down and giant vultures plucking your head off. You know, it didn't feel safe or welcoming. I could see all these things happening, you know, which things that now seem quaint and safe, you know, like Philly soul or glam or, you know, that kind of thing. But I, for me, the grail was to make music like it had been in 1967, not flowers and love and sunshine and all that, but that thing of the 3-minute pop song that had all these different layers to it that was kind of almost too intense to exist, you know, like Good Vibrations or See Emily Play or Are You Experienced or 8 Miles High. I thought that's the thing. To me, that's the genre.
Yeah.
And of course, the great practitioners of that were the Fabs. You know, I Am the Walrus, Day in the Life. Then particularly, once you've got two guitars, bass and drums, Revolver. So Dr. Robert and Your Bird Can Sing, that's sort of the John ones, but that sort of birdsy end of the Beatles. But the Paul songs were fantastic too. You know, Revolver, they're all kind of, they're still level pretty much.
Yeah.
And George has got 3 songs on there. You know, to me, that's the sort of miracle record. And I just thought, I suppose Revolver was the template. You know, I thought I've got to get 2 guitars, bass and drums and some harmonies and just carry on making Revolver type music.
Yeah.
I remember sending someone a postcard in 1974 saying I'm hell bent on being psychedelic. Am I flogging a dead horse? I don't know if they ever replied to me, but you know, so, time went on and pre-punk, everything I did or wanted to do, I was too inept for people to really see what it was I was trying to do. And then I hooked up with the other soft boys and they were technically able to start realizing the things I wanted to do, you know, in the first couple of soft boys records. But they were very experimental in a way. They were experimental pieces of music. But I remember the first thing we did and wading through a ventilator and everybody, you know, correctly said, oh, Sid Barrett, you know, especially when I double track my voice and things. But somebody else said, you know what this sounds like? It's the Beatles. And I remember hearing a live Soft Boys tape playing in the other room and I thought it was Dylan. So and those were my real, you know, that's the real flower bed out of which I grew. and neither the Beatles nor Dylan were at all what people wanted during punk.
No.
So again, you know, we kind of hatched out too late in some ways and too early in other ways. And when the Bunnymen, Echo and the Bunnymen and Julian Cope and all that lot happened in the early 80s, that people were ready for a psychedelic thing, but they weren't ready when we did it. And then when Oasis came along and went full Beatle, you know, that was 2 generations after the Soft Boys. So I was just very aware of being an anachronism.
Well, what you were doing, you were at Soft Boys, were carrying the flag through a wasteland.
We were carrying, like I said, you know, I knew it was. We were went through the portal, and it was going to be hostile territory, and it was.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Did you find in the software, did you find like-minded people, or did you have to did you have to convince them that this is the what was the right thing to be doing, or were they already there?
Well, I went to Cambridge because it was a finite. I couldn't hack it in London. My ego was too fragile, and I was just too young to. I wish I had. I wish I'd been around and gone to all the pub rock gigs where punk incubated. I wish I'd got to know those people. You know, the Clash and the
Brinsleys.
The Brinsleys. I mean, Nick Lowe's quite an old friend now, but I wasn't. Yeah, that lot. Probably them more than the punk people, but. Yeah, so I had a friend in Cambridge I had a good jam with, and so I went up there, and it took me a couple of years, but I eventually recruited the musicians that everybody spoke about, you know. Kimberly Rue, people said, you've got to see this guy Kim Rue, he's an amazing guitarist, you know, he's very good. And someone said, this drummers, what you want to get hold of is Maurice Windsor. You know, and we had a couple of different bass players, but they were all very respected musicians, and they were all into some of them liked Steely Dan and the Beach Boys. Some of them liked, Kim was a big Star and Kinks fan, but everybody liked Beatles. So in between my songs, you know, me working my stuff out with them, we would just go and play Beatles records. It would keep everybody interested. I had this a couple of weeks ago in Nashville. We were playing God, I don't know what we were doing. We did a few Beatles songs as the encore with sort of guest vocalists.
Wilco, you were doing Tomorrow Never Knows. I saw that.
We did Tomorrow Never Knows and I Am the Walrus. Yeah. Pat Sansone, who's in Wilco, is also in my Nashville ensemble, the Nashville Fabs, no less. But my wife Emma named them that, but it's apt. They're Beatles freaks. So, you know, we were all that same thing of trying to work out. You get a bunch of musicians together. Yeah. Now, what is that chord? And it invariably comes up. And the Soft Boys were no exception. So, yeah, we would sit there, you know, working out She's So Heavy and all that. I mean, to this day, if I'm with people, it keeps going back to that.
It's a common language for professional
musicians.
It's
a common language. And then, you know, I suppose that's the thing. If there's, to me, the Beatles was a school, it was an academy, and it had three songwriting graduates, John, Paul and George. And what really comes through is after it's over, they're still there, they are, and they're still doing these minor sixths.
Yeah.
There's actually, whatever their disagreements, their musical language is exactly the same. They've all got, they're equipped with that stuff somewhere between Tamla Motown and George Formby. There's all these different little ingredients they have, but they all have them. And then you look on, the camera pans back, and I look at Elvis Costello, Andy Partridge, Difford and Tilbrook, all the sort of second generation Beatle kids, myself. And that's just in Britain. But it's all people who were in that, of that school.
Yes.
And at that point, you think, well, there actually is a genre of Beatle music. So Andy Partridge and I get together when we can, and we put out an EP, which I can get you one. I've got one.
They're for sale around the corner in Tower Records.
Are they?
Yes, they are.
Is there a Tower Records?
There's a Tower Records in Dublin.
Independent.
An independent Tower Records.
And it's for sale.
It is for sale.
Gods, the distribution must have kicked in.
So, we can nip round and
are not sponsoring us in any way. But it is definitely there.
Okay, well, there's that. The record, we put out a 4-track EP last year on Andy's label, Ape. But we're working on what I hope, if we both last long enough, would be an LP a full length, and that's, you know, that is Beatle music. Essentially, you know, Andy and I basically write to the same rules.
One of the things I heard you say about that was that you and Andy are still trying to make the missing Beatles album.
Yes,
you're still, which I thought that's a very noble ambition. That's a
I don't think we've even sort of discussed that, but I can tell that's what we're doing. You know, you can see that as soon as we get into the shed and he starts getting his effects on things.
But you can see, but you can hear that, consistent. Yeah. I don't pretend to have every single one of your 21 albums.
Me neither.
But you can hear sort of on almost every album there are those chords and those sounds and sort of bubbling up.
Yeah.
I was saying to Jason, we were having a coffee before the, and I was saying, is it I Pray When I'm Drunk?
Oh yeah,
which just sounds like a Ringo song from Rubber Soul. It sounds that era. It's that sort of country. No, you're going to say no, that's not.
No, it's actually it's kind of it's sort of Dr. Robert, the music maybe, but I hadn't thought of and
Virginia Woolf.
Virginia Woolf.
That has a very Revolver sound to me.
Oh, it should. Yeah, that's great. No,
and it just comes up. But
once I've got two guitars, bass, and drums, and harmonies, then I'm basically going to be aiming for that Revolver sound. I lack the initiative to try anything new. You know, it's like a blues purist or something. You know, the Rolling Stones basically almost academically studied the Chicago blues. Yeah. I mean, you know, they developed a different sound in the end, but that, it's a genre, I suppose.
It's interesting to hear
musically, anyway.
Yeah,
it is interesting to hear you put it like that. But like, it's a manifesto to listen to that music and try and write what comes next. And I certainly, you know, I love Andy Partridge as well, and the Dukes of Stratosphere and all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting that more people don't do that. I know it's a hard thing to do because what you tend to get is Beatle pastiche more so from, you know, from people who create something that they think is Beatley,
but Oasis, it's not actually. It's Oasis you're talking about.
Well, I'm not totally talking about Oasis, but I think there's a difference between, oh, we're going to do something that kind of sounds like the Beatles, or we're going to take the work that they did and we're going to try and infuse it with our own originality and our own belief and imagination. Some of it's done without imagination, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Does that seem unfair?
Well, if you don't have an imagination, then you're not going to imagine very much. But I mean, different elements appeal to different people. So Neil Innes sort of got the sound perfectly and down to the sort of Lennon chewing gum and singing. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, he's faultless.
You know, and whereas the Oasis brothers had Noel Gallagher kind of grew up going to football matches and thought, that's what I want to write. I want to write songs that a stadium will sing.
Yeah.
Whereas me, I probably went to, you know, I sat on the floor cross-legged at little gigs and thought, I want to write songs that only 73 people will listen to. You know, because I was also into the Incredible String Band and Captain Beefheart and stuff that was very much not for everybody. And that side of my psyche has won out over Beatle Robin, which is you know, the Beatle side of me is universal, but the Incredible String Band, Sid Barrett, Captain Beefheart, Lou Reed kind of side of me is very much, no, I'm doing this for a small group of people who are going to get what I'm doing. I'm not interested in trying to, you know, God forbid a football stadium should walk in. So, you know, my career has been very emphatically avoided any kind of success in that respect.
But that is a Beatle thing, that you do what's true to yourself and you do, you know, if anyone else likes it, that's...
Yeah. I mean, it's just lucky that they were able to be true to foreselves for quite a long time. And then I suppose, you know, Maxwell Silverhammer didn't feel true to John and George.
Yeah.
And everything was true to Ringo. I don't know if he had favorites. And Paul's so adaptable. You know, he could, any style of music they could come up with, he contributed. And John, I think John and George, obviously I wasn't in the group, but they were quite dismissive of what he did to their songs, because once he'd gone, their songs really lacked. They lacked that sort of hooky bass line. They lacked, you know, Klaus Voormann was nice, but he wasn't going to make any trouble. That's the trouble. Everybody then, it's that same old thing. You get big and you don't want anyone around who's going to stand up to you. And the only people who stand up to you, the other guys in the band. So, you know, Mick and Keith or whatever. But
well, you can kind of say that Paul, for all his I know he's often labelled as the guy who announced the Beatles split, but he was kind of almost the guy who never left the Beatles. George had a run, Ringo had a run, John had a run.
He said, "I was the last to leave."
Hmm.
I think he really... No, I don't think he... I think he knew what he had.
Yeah.
But that's the other thing. Time shows that Paul was, as someone's recently said, the adult of the group. Mm. He was the realist, you know.
Well, certainly as a teenager, I felt Paul was a bit embarrassing. Now that I'm older and I've, you know, family and all that kind of stuff, you kind of see more what he's doing when you see his whole career in retrospect. You kind of go, okay, I get it a bit more now. And I love some of that stuff I would have sneered at as a 15-year-old. Something like a song like Sea Moon, when I first heard that, I really didn't like it. And now I think it's just a fantastic kind of little nugget of what was in his head at that time.
What about Wonderful Christmas Time?
I will defend that song to the ends of the
really?
Earth. Yeah.
Whoa, you like it?
Yeah, here's my take.
Yeah.
I love Paul McCartney records and recordings, which are just him opening his head and tipping it onto the tape.
Yeah.
And Wonderful Christmas Time was done in about 12 hours in a studio on his own. And I think if you strip out the vocal and the sleigh bells, it's a very strange, weird backing track of squelchy synths and whining synths, and there isn't really a lot going on. And for him to go, yep, that's a Christmas song. There's a quote from Clive James I heard after he died, which was Paul McCartney has the knack of making, making the unobvious seem inevitable. And I thought, yeah, that is, and Wonderful Christmas Time, people kind of knock songs like that and knock songs like Mullet Can Tire. And I'm like, you could sing, anyone in the street could sing that song from the core of their DNA. And I think that's a gift in and of itself. I do love Wonderful Christmas Time,
oh,
I'm afraid.
Oh, it's a gift. I mean, I completely admire the way he did. A really interesting point about the backing track.
Yeah.
I suppose that's one of the big differences between me and him. I would have kept Yesterday as Scrambled Egg.
Yes.
Those are much more me kind of lyrics, or John lyrics, I suppose. And Wonderful Christmas Time, I would have put something completely uncommercial over the top of. It would have probably been more like Ian Dury or something.
Yes.
But, you know, wouldn't have sold.
Yeah.
Have you heard the McGear album? Mike
his
McGear,
brother.
His brother, was there's an album that was released, and we're both big fans.
It's back, but it's him backed by Wings, essentially.
So it's basically Wings in 1974, done in 10cc studio, and it's extremely odd.
Yeah.
And you think Paul felt able to do that, standing behind his brother, but when it came to Wonderful Christmas Time, he's back to being Paul. So no matter how odd the music or how he feels the need to polish it up, put a nice commercial lyric on it. Whereas if, as you say, if he can just sort of tip the contents of his head onto a table, the way he did, I really recommend you listen.
Oh, really?
The older I get,
it's very.
But is it his brother? Is it Mike's lyrics?
It's his lyrics,
right?
And one of
and
the
he's
other
singing them over Paul's music.
Paul has written sort of the melodies and the songs.
Yeah.
But one of the interesting things, you think, well, what would Wings have been like if someone like Mike McGear, who is a poet, really, had provided the lyrics? If Paul had felt, as you say, suddenly maybe Scrambled Eggs is the right lyric, and he goes with that. But I think his commercial, he's a pleaser. He needs the approval.
Well, he does that showbiz thing, but I think when you look at the core of it, I think Paul McCartney's a very strange man. Like, I think he's really odd, and, you know, in the 80s, when I was a pop kid, he was wearing jumpers and popping up at Noel Edmonds, and it just all seemed a little bit off. But, you know, when you actually think of what he's doing and how he's managed to stay reasonably sane, I think some of the stuff when you go into the nooks and crannies is quite odd. And if you approach Wonderful Christmas Time as the song of an odd man, it actually sounds different, I think.
Well, that's a good point. Maybe he's actually an alien who's had to disguise himself as a human, so he's made a point of trying to make himself seem as normcore as possible.
Well, yeah, normcore is
normcore.
Is that a genre?
He said in some interview, well, you know, I'm like people, that's why I'm successful. But actually, maybe that's the thing, he's like people, but he isn't one.
It's like somebody's told him what a person is sometimes.
And so he's replicated it.
There's a brilliant YouTube video of Paul McCartney making mashed potatoes, which you watch it and it's like he's never seen a potato before. He doesn't really know what's going on. And he obviously has his gifts, but it ain't in mashing potatoes.
Really?
And, yeah.
Is he doing it with Linda or something?
It was a thing he did for a Linda cookbook back in the day. And so I think it was a little online video or something, and somebody's put it up. And he's very charming and nice and all the rest, but he's, you know, he's trying to deflect from the fact that he's not making great mashed potatoes.
I looked at, I watched that, and the first thing that came into my head was weed. And I thought,
it's, yeah.
But you're right. He this is the thing, you know, I'm People. He has a song, Average Person, where he's kind of, imagine what it would be like to be an engine driver, or imagine what it would be like to be a, and you're thinking, well, we don't have to because we are engine drivers. And,
well, I suppose, you know, it's so long ago,
it's overrated
since he was in that world. So perhaps he wants to hold on to it. But
well, he now writes these retrospective songs of I was on a bus and I had a job before I was famous and all that kind of stuff.
And he must be remembering a long way back.
I think he's holding on to some threads there. But myth. I think that's where his sanity is. You know, otherwise it's...
But there are interesting things about him. Like he apparently doesn't... And I've seen him... He doesn't appear to rehydrate during a three-hour gig.
No,
he doesn't
strange.
Take any water,
no.
Nor does he sweat. And he...
We're back to the alien theory.
We're back to the alien theory. And it's possible that he is... You're right. Maybe he's a replicant of counterfeit. He's a human-style human. God, I mean, I wouldn't... Plus, he's lasted.
Yeah.
You know, he has an equilibrium which is absolutely staggering.
Yes.
You can see even by the end of the Beatles that, you know, the others. I mean, John and George took more acid, and they whatever they were obviously pretty clobbered by the whole process. There's George gives that interview later years saying, "Well, you know, the Beatles gave their central nervous systems," and they were maybe rather ungrateful for what the world gave them, even. But Paul, just he is so insanely buoyant.
Yeah,
you know,
he seems very self-contained. Post Beatles, he was the one that didn't want to leave. He was the last person to leave. But well, since the Beatles, he's you know, we were saying he doesn't seem to hang out with showbiz types. I don't know that you could name his.
Well, I think he's a great compartmentalizer, and he didn't.
Yeah,
there's all these stories about Paul of when he was a teenager, he'd get on the bus in Liverpool and pretend to be a poet, or he'd smoke a pipe, or he'd imagine himself into being a thing. And I think he's in the 50th year or 60th year of his project of imagining himself as the world's biggest pop star. And, you know, who knows what it would take to take that away. I don't know, but it's working.
Well, it's an interesting role, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he's definitely the man for the job.
Have you ever met or interacted with any of them in person?
No. The only thing, I actually did quite literally bump into Paul McCartney at a Peter Blake's birthday party. I used to be a neighbour of Peter Blake's when I lived in West London. And he had a 80th birthday party upstairs at the Albert Hall. Madness were playing, funnily enough. And Paul McCartney was dancing and he bumped into me, or I bumped him and I said, sorry, whoops, and that was it. But that's my closest
that's
I've
your
got
interaction.
To him. That's my only interaction.
That's enough, that's all you
but,
need.
But, you know, he was definitely there. I've seen him. He was at a Brian Wilson gig. I saw him there, and I've seen him on stage a couple of times. So, so you know, I know he's there. His voice has got a bit thin. It was quite spotty when I saw him in Sydney a couple of years ago. And last year in Las Vegas, I think it was less spotty, but it was a bit thin.
That's where Stephen
was. That's where I saw him. You were at the Vegas gig.
Yes,
I was there.
Did you go to the sound check?
No, I couldn't get tickets.
Oh, okay. The
were you at the sound check?
Well, a friend of ours took us, and he very generously bought the sound check tickets.
Very
and
nice.
That's great because it's kind of faux sound check. You know, they're not in their stage gear, and there's bits where they stop and confer. But Paul's still addressing the 100 people who've paid whatever it is extra to go and watch.
Yeah.
And you're all quite near the stage.
I tried so hard to get
He did. God, he started out with Honey Don't, I think, and he played Ram, which was nice, Ram On. And he played a lot of just covers that,
I would love if he would do those songs in the main set. He just seems so fixed he has a fixed set list. There's maybe two songs swapped out every night, and it's just the same thing, note after note, you know, night after night, yes, same note for note. But were you there the night that Steven Tyler?
Oh,
came
God,
on?
I'm afraid so, yeah.
I was there the next night.
Oh, you were there the following night?
I was there the following
night. Was he not there?
He wasn't there.
Oh, shit, I should have gone to that, yeah.
well, then I shouldn't say, but two days after that, I actually did pick up a ticket and I went to see Aerosmith.
Oh, and Paul McCartney turn up?
I was convinced Paul McCartney was going to turn up because Tyler came out, sat down, and he played the piano and sang the opening lines of Golden Slumbers once I was away to get back home. Oh. And I just for a second, I thought...
Paul's going to come out.
And he just played it and he said, I just have to get that off my chest. Oh. But did you not feel in that the affection that the audience had for him at those shows? I was sort of down maybe about sort of 10 or 12 rows back from the stage.
Yeah.
I could just feel in a way that the English gigs just didn't.
Well, that's the thing. I haven't seen him here. Mm. I mean, I saw him here in 1973 at Hammersmith Odeon.
Wow.
And at that point, he wasn't doing any Beatles songs, and there wasn't much Wings. I mean, he hadn't even written Band on the Run, so he was drawing from three records, Red Road Speedway.
Yeah,
they had the sort of five part harmonies that were pretty good. Big barn bed. He did Long Tall Sally as one of the encores, but by the end of that decade, he was already playing Beatles songs. Yeah. That's another interesting thing is watching people turn into oldies acts. I remember seeing Brian Ferry in the mid-90s, and he did some Roxy Music stuff, but a lot of it was from his latest album with horses on it, in that country gentleman phase. Yeah, and then next time I saw him, it was much more oldies, and last time I saw him, it was almost completely from Avalon and... Yeah. Flesh and Blood, and there was like one song from his solo.
Yeah.
There was nothing after Slave to Love. Mm. And Paul didn't do anything after Temporary Secretary. He didn't do it. I mean, he did Here Today.
Yeah.
And he did a couple of songs.
He always does new album songs just as a nod.
Well, he did one or two, and he might have said it the night he said, well, because we see you up there. When we see you with the camera, bringing the cameras out for the old ones, and we're doing all that. Mm-hmm. So we know you don't pull them out so much for a new one, but we're going to do it anyway. And, he's aware of the fact that the new ones don't go down so well because new songs don't resonate all the way back. And I've learned that myself, that, I am, with my tiny clientele, I too am an oldies act. And if I want people to like my new stuff, the less of it I play, the better. you front load the set with old songs, you finish with old songs, you spike, And in fact, if I didn't play anything after 1990, most of my crowd would be just as happy. It either reminds them of being young or they're younger people who are into, they've discovered me through their parents or YouTube, they're music students. So it all goes back.
Yeah.
And the longer people have lived with a song, the more it resonates with them. It doesn't mean your new stuff isn't good, but it hasn't.
You're fighting against the old stuff.
Yeah, you've got your own history and you've got their own history as well. So unfortunately, the only person who can be an exception to that is Bob Dylan. But it's a very strange, and his thing is he'll play some old songs, but you won't recognize them. But the good performances from Dylan are when he does songs that are less than 20 years old and they haven't melted. So anyway, there we are. We've covered the world.
There's one or two things I wanted to finish with. And one was when you play a Beatles song for an audience, do you notice something in the audience? Because I have to admit, the first ever concert camera clip I think I was sent was you, Nick Lowe, and Elvis Costello singing If I Fell in concert about 10 years ago. Somebody sent me a YouTube link.
Oh, is there?
And I thought, that's great. I'm sure you probably don't approve of cameras in concerts. But if you unleash a song like that, do you think audiences have a different response to Beatle music?
Well, it depends how well you do it. I mean, they were excited because Costello got up with us.
And
I'm not sure how good the version was that we did, but they're Beatles songs, so they resonate.
Yeah.
I mean, they're great songs. And I think also probably if I'm singing a Beatles song, I'm probably performing differently. I'm not trying to... If I do somebody else's song, I'm channeling them. I'm not trying to interpret them.
Yeah.
I'm not really interested in... I'm going to put a Robin Hitchcock spin on this. As far as I'm concerned, especially if it's Lennon, I'm simply trying to get as close to the original sound as I can.
Yeah.
And, you know, the guitars, the whole, okay, we're going to do something off Revolver. Can we make those guitars clang and chime that way?
Yeah.
Can we get that? We'll double track the harmony so it actually... It's got that, you know, live sound. So I or people I'm playing with, even if it's, you know, whether it's Wilco or the Nashville Fabs or, you know, in the old days, the Softboy, whoever I've got with me, I'm always trying to make it sound, feel like the original. So I'm method acting, you know.
Well, it's that version of Cold Turkey.
Yeah.
On Can of Bees.
Well, that's so long ago. That's probably... I think I've perfected my John Lennon imitation much better. I was probably still sound a bit like Robin Hitchcock there, and I'm sort of shouting. I would do it much more faithfully now. I think I just didn't know how to do it faithfully.
Well, you'll not be surprised to know that's the song that made me buy that album back in
Can't
the day.
Bees. But wow.
What I like about that is you put a bass line. It's almost a danceable bass line that you have on that, and I like to think there was some talk back in 69, you know, Lennon brought Cold Turkey in and said, this is the next single, and George and Paul said, no, we're not, the Beatles aren't doing Cold Turkey, and I like to imagine that that's what you were going for. You were thinking, well, how would the Beatles version of Cold Turkey?
Oh, well, that would be the bass player, Andy Metcalf, who played on that, so he was probably, I don't suppose... Yeah, he would have put something melodic in there.
If you cried that bass line up, it's Cold Turkey as a dance number. It's fantastic.
I'll have to have a listen.
Well, last thing before we let you go. This might seem like an obvious question. Do you still listen to the Beatles, or do you like these reissues or the bootlegs and all these kind of bonus tracks? Or do you find that they're so on the fingertips of your brain that you can just listen to them in your head any time? Or would you still put on a Beatles record?
No, I still put on Beatles records. I haven't listened extensively to the Giles Martin remixes, but again, I think there's a place for them. I don't think it's sacrilegious. You know, it just means that certain things become clarified that weren't there before. But I just think, okay, there's the mono mixes, certainly of Sgt. Pepper and White Album. Then there's the stereo mixes, and now there is the enhanced mix. And there's a place, you know, I like hearing a clarified version of what's happening in Mr. Kite. You know, there's certain things where you just hear it much more clearly. I don't think it's better. It's just different.
Yeah, it's more to enjoy.
But, you know, I'm really happy to shell out the extra 30 quid for yet another version. That's our classical music. It's our folk music. It's like the best thing that Britain produced. It's the best thing that, you know, to me, if you had to justify humanity, you know, you've got on one side, you've got Hitler and Donald Trump and nuclear weapons and the Holocaust and things that, you know, things I've done myself which aren't in that league but aren't that great. There's all the horror of humanity, which I, you know, we're a pretty shitty species, really. and then, you know, what's on the other hand? It's the Beatles. To me, the Beatles sort of justifies, it's like Shakespeare. It's just sort of, there's some essence of brilliance and emotional intelligence and whatever it is that makes life worth living.
Yeah.
The Beatles have it. And it's also kind of universal. You always mythologize your own youth. So it's hard to tell, and I guess, will people feel this way about Ed Sheeran in 50 years time? Maybe they will, but, you know, just the most popular musical act in the world was also the greatest, and that's another thing where you feel there's a higher power was at work, you know.
Robin Hitchcock, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us today about the conversation that never ends, the conversation about the Beatles.
Thanks for having me very much.
And that's all from this time round. We are available online in the usual places on Twitter at Beatles Pod.
Yeah.
You can also go on and join the Facebook group, and Stephen might let you in or might not let you in. He'll decide what's going on. And until next time, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thank you for listening.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.